From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Americans are always being told to save more money, save as much as you can. But what would happen if you pushed that notion to the extreme? Saving everything, every last cent you bring home. Okay, so there's the mortgage, rent, and other loans you can't escape, and obviously you have to eat too. But beyond that, what if you didn't spend a single dollar on anything else? Well, it's called extreme frugality, and one couple says that it's the key not only to financial freedom, but something even deeper, living the joyful life you've always wanted. This hour on Point, let's take a walk on the frugal side. You can join us on air or online. Are you ready to embrace extreme frugality? Or are you already taking steps in that direction? And what are you doing to achieve a life of financial freedom? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And also, by the way, a little later this hour, we're going to take a look at Amazon's possible play for your checking account. But joining me first from Norwich, Vermont, is Elizabeth Willard-Thames. She's the founder of the personal finance blog Frugal Woods, and her new book is Meet the Frugal Woods, Achieving Financial Independence Through Simple Living. Liz, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you. Now, I come from a penny-pinching family myself, so your book is chasing after my own heart here. But I wonder if we could sort of start near the beginning of when you wanted to make this transition to extreme frugality. I mean, what kind of life were you living that was calling out for profound change?
I was living a very conventional life. So throughout my 20s, I was so focused on following the prescribed path, the shoulds, the what you are supposed to do. So I went to college, got good grades, graduated, got a job, got another job, went to graduate school, got married, bought a house, adopted a dog. So really kind of followed this path that I thought would lead me to fulfillment and would lead me to contentment. And when I turned 30 in 2014, I had this realization that I was profoundly unfulfilled, that I didn't know where I was going in my life and what I was hoping to achieve. And at that time, my husband asked me, well, when are you happiest? And I said, well, I'm happiest when I'm out hiking in the woods. And yet we were living in the middle of urban Cambridge, Massachusetts, right outside of Boston. We lived in New York City and Washington, D.C., and had these very standard 9-to-5 jobs. We both worked for nonprofit organizations, and so we felt like we were pursuing work that was meaningful, but we had this deep feeling of not being fulfilled and of not really achieving what we hope to achieve.
Well, can I ask you a quick question here? Because, I mean, in your book, you write that contrary to what, like, a quick glance might lead people to think, it's not as if you were sort of rolling in the cash of the wealthy coastal elite, right? I mean, you were living a more or less normal lifestyle. And in fact, you were talking in your book, you talk about when you were growing up, it's a very sort of solidly middle class, recognizable lifestyle. So it's not so much money that was leading to a lack of fulfillment, right?
Absolutely, yes. So I grew up in a very wonderful, loving, middle-class family, fantastic parents who are still married. They've been married for over 50 years. But it's certainly not a family with lots of money, and I didn't inherit money, neither did my husband. And like I said, we both worked for nonprofits because we were truly trying to work for something with a greater mission, with a greater cause than ourselves. But we recognized that we weren't living in the way that we really wanted to be. Uh-huh. And we thought, you know, we're going to turn 40, 50, 60 and never have truly done what we hope to do with our lives.
Right. So let me ask you, because I think this is a fulcrum that a lot of people, a lot of families arrive at. And we should say those who have the luxury of arriving at this point. But but there's a choice. And some families say, well, in order to feel that sense of accomplishment and fulfillment and finding the things that give us greater joy, what we actually need to do, and I have no bone to pick with this outcome, but a lot of people think I need to actually earn more because that'll give me greater access to opportunities and chances and experiences. But you chose the complete opposite direction. Why? I mean, why go towards the direction of this extreme frugality?
Because spending money didn't make us happy. So as we advanced in our careers, our salaries increased, and we increased our spending. And I will say, at a certain point, money absolutely makes life better. It makes life easier. There's absolutely no denial of that. When I went from not having a washer dryer in my apartment to having a washer dryer in my apartment, that's a huge leap in improvement in your quality of life. When I went from not owning a car to owning a car, it was a 20-year-old car, but a car nevertheless, my life did improve. And so to a certain point, more money will make your life easier and will make your life better. But then beyond that, what I discovered is that a lot of this spending that I was doing was an effort, an attempt to bring happiness to myself, and it didn't work.
Talk about lattes. Yeah, no, I was going to say, give us some examples. You talk about lattes and clothes and eating out.
Oh, yes, the lattes, the clothes. It's mostly food for me, so lots of eating out. And sure, I enjoyed it, and there would be sort of a high of pleasure and enjoyment there. But then what happens is this phenomenon of hedonic adaptation, whereby we then need more. We need to eat out more frequently. We need to buy that latte every single day in order to derive that same level of benefit. And that's absolutely what happened to me. So I felt, well, if getting takeout one night a week was good, then I bet two nights a week would be even better. And so I continually ramped up my spending until this point when I turned 30 and recognized, okay, I see what I'm doing here. Mm-hmm. I am spending money in an effort to make myself feel better about the fact that for the vast majority of my life, I'm in an office working on things that I'm not deeply passionate about. Mm-hmm. And I'm spending money to try and assuage that sort of unhappiness that I'm feeling. And so what if I stopped spending? How would I feel? And the answer for me was profound joy.
Well, but stop spending, but you would still be working in that same office that wasn't giving you any joy.
Yes, that is true. For me, the pivot point was coming up with a long-term goal.
Right.
Deciding where I wanted to be in my life in 10 years, in 20, in 30, really taking a long-term perspective. And what I recognized is that I wanted to live on a homestead in the woods. And that's what my husband wanted to do too. And so we began to craft this vision of us living in a rural environment on a lot of land surrounded by woods, which for both of us is where we are just the happiest people. And so once we had this vision, this homestead, which we moved to in May 2016, we now live on 66 acres in rural Vermont with our two very young daughters. Once we had that vision in mind, it became very easy to save money, because when the decision is, do I want to buy a new pair of boots or do I want to live the life of my dreams? I think I'll take the life of my dreams.
Okay, and so you're setting goals, and these are both sort of family goals. They're happiness goals, and they're also financial goals, right? So you're basically saying when you get focused, things get easier. But let me ask you about, okay, so the decision got made. You craft your vision. I mean, all of a sudden, a postcard view of an idyllic New England farm is dancing around in my head. But what were the first steps? What are the first things that you cut? And be perfectly honest with me. Was it as easy as you're making it sound?
Not in the first month. Let me tell you, the first month of anything, whether it's a diet or a financial plan, having a new child, I have a 2-week-old, so I can tell you the first month, not going to be the best. But the key is when you start to see these benefits accrue over time. So the first step for anybody who wants to start gaining control of their money today is to track your expenses. Mm-hmm. That sounds overly simplistic, but I was not doing it. I had no idea how much we were spending every month.
How did you do that? I mean, there are lots of apps that are designed to do that, but then you have to have a smartphone, which is also expensive.
Well, I am a fan of the internet, and I am a fan of free software, and so I recommend either Mint or Personal Capital. These are both free expense trackers that you can use. You can also use a spreadsheet, piece of paper, whatever you want to do, as long as you have a holistic vision of every dollar you're spending.
Mm-hmm.
And don't try to estimate it, because you will definitely underestimate.
Yeah.
I certainly do. I still do to this day. So look at the raw numbers and go through every line item and ask yourself, okay, is this a discretionary expense or is this a fixed mandatory expense?
So
and
tell
I
me,
will
yeah.
save. Sorry, go ahead.
No, sorry, I didn't mean to jump in on you there, but I'm really interested to know the details. I've loved for folks to hear the details of what were the kinds of things that you started cutting. And the reason why I ask is because, you know, I think it's completely understandable if people look around their own lives and think maybe there isn't much to cut, but you found lots of things that you could do without.
Yes. And when we started this project, my husband and I learned that we were saving about 42% of our take-home salaries.
You're already doing pretty well then.
We were already saving at a pretty high rate, but we said, you know what? I think we can do better. So we cut truly everything that was not mandatory for our existence. So the things that I define as fixed are your mortgage or your rent, and then any debt that you need to repay. Everything else is discretionary. So you'll note that I did not include groceries in the fixed and mandatory category because I found opportunities for savings in every line item. And in some cases, it's a straight out cut. So the lattes of the world, they just had to go. They were completely gone from my life. What I did, though, was create a very nice at-home coffee environment. So I really encourage people, don't see it as deprivation. See it as an opportunity to insource your lattes. So I have a very nice burr grinder for my coffee beans. I have an excellent kettle that heats my water to just the right temperature so I can make fantastic coffee at my house every day. So it does not feel like I've lost out on the pleasure of that cup of coffee.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by the new CNN original series, Pope, the Most Powerful Man in History, a dramatic new six-part series narrated by Liam Neeson that links recent news events surrounding the Vatican to their unexpected historical origins in the Catholic Church. From the start of the papacy to struggles with corruption to the challenges faced by wartime popes, go inside the Vatican to explore the roles of popes throughout history and how they spread Catholicism around the world. Pope airs Sundays at 10 p.m. Eastern on CNN.
Hey there, I'm Joshua Johnson, the host of 1A. There are lots of places to debate today's issues if you don't mind getting attacked for speaking your mind or asking a simple question. But 1A is different. You'll find the 1A podcast on the NPR One app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about extreme frugality and what it means to cut your expenses down to a minimum that might lead to more joyful living. We're talking with Elizabeth Willard Thames. She's founder of the personal finance blog Frugal Woods and author of Meet the Frugal Woods, Achieving Financial Independence Through Simple Living. Liz, can you humor me for a second? And let's do a little lightning round in terms of things that you cut and how you cut them. Can we? Because
yes.
I love the details of how one adopts this lifestyle. So a little lightning round here. We talked about coffee before the break. So you created sort of an at-home coffee environment. So restaurant food out, I presume.
Out. And my husband is an excellent cook. So he made a Thai red curry dish last night, better than any Thai restaurant I've been to. So, you know, you do these things over and over at home, you will get better at them.
Okay.
You will become a really good Thai cook.
Okay. So restaurant food gone. Now, you mentioned groceries before. How are you minimizing your expenses on grocery food?
Primarily by buying bulk raw ingredients. So we don't buy hummus in a package. We buy the raw ingredients. We don't buy things that are pre-made. We cook them from scratch. So I make our own bread. We make, you know, pretty much everything that you can make from scratch, we do. And so we eat very healthy, organic, whole foods that we cook from scratch.
Okay. Now, clothing.
I have not bought any clothing, actually, in 4 years, and I have been pregnant twice. So finding ways to minimize my consumption is another element of my frugality. So beyond saving money, I love that I consume less. I own less. I have less. I'm throwing away much less. And I'm keeping things out of landfills because I take hand-me-downs from friends. I shop at garage sales. And I found I have plenty of clothes. Huh. I really don't need to buy new clothes at this stage.
And they're lasting? They're lasting
long
enough?
They are lasting. I hang them up to dry for the most part. So keeping them out of the dryer does extend their lifespan.
All right. What about travel?
That we did not cut, so that's a priority for us. And the key with all of this is know what matters the most to you. Spend on what matters and let go of everything else. So we travel, before we had kids, we traveled internationally quite a bit. Now we mostly travel domestically a few times a year for vacation to visit families. That's something that's important to us. And so, you know, we don't eliminate that from our budget.
Okay. Now, you're a mom too, though. And when babies are on the way, there's I just call it the baby industrial complex that's
yes.
ready to pour the desire to buy stuff into your life for your little person when genuinely all they need is to like stay warm and be well fed and loved. But how did you fight all that off?
So I always like to say it's more expensive to have a child than to not have a child. Let's be clear. But it is nowhere near the cost of that you hear often touted. So primarily hand-me-downs, secondhand and hand-me-downs. No need to buy new clothes. No need to buy a new changing table. Everything that we have for our kids is used. And most of it was hand-me-downs from friends who said, you know, we're done with this. Would you like to have it? Or purchased at garage sales, thrift stores for just a fraction of the price. Yeah. And again, it's about priorities. You know, we pay, for example, for our older daughter to go to a Waldorf preschool because she loves it. We love it. That's a priority for us. Buying her new clothes, not a priority at all.
Mm. So all these things put together, the most expensive thing I hear is your time. So are you not working in a conventional job anymore? Has all this frugality led to the fact that that you don't need to work outside the home?
So we don't need to work. It's true. My husband and I are financially independent, and so we no longer need to work to earn a living. But what I have actually found controversially, is that frugality saves you time, which I did not anticipate at all. But by not shopping, not consuming, staying sort of out of that rat race and out of that keeping up with the Joneses mindset, I have so much more time to pursue the things that matter to me.
Yeah. Can I just jump in here? So at the risk of being too nosy, but journalistically so, you're financially independent because of your frugality or because you have other sources of income?
I would say it's a combination of factors. So certainly, in order to be successful in your frugality, you have to have something to save. I think that's certainly the other side of the equation, of course, is income. And then there's the question of time. How long do you need to save for in order to reach a point at which you would be financially independent?
Yeah.
And so there's, you know, it's not as though you can only be frugal. I think you need to take into account the importance of investments. So we invest in low-fee index funds. We also have a donor-advised fund through which we contribute to charity. We have 529 college saving accounts for our daughters. And importantly, we also rent out the home that we used to live in outside of Boston.
Uh-huh.
Yes. And so we have rental property can be a great source of passive
okay,
income.
Okay. So look, I appreciate your candor on this because while the sort of overall spirit of your book, again, it speaks to my heart a lot, there's something I can't help escape, a particular thought. So bear with me on this. And that is, you acknowledge that this was a choice that you made. This is a lifestyle that you're choosing for reasons of your own happiness. But taken another way, I mean, I'm thinking of the millions of Americans who do not have a choice, that frugality is a fact of their lives because of poverty.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, is this sort of, are we putting some sex appeal on a lifestyle that many people are desperate to escape?
I am very cognizant that my frugality is elective. And I'm very cognizant that because it's elective, I view it as a point of joy. However, for many people, that is not the case. And for me, frugality is truly the epitomization of a gratitude mindset. I am profoundly privileged, and I think I'm extremely lucky that I get to choose to save money. That's something I'm able to choose every single day. And so in no way is my frugality deprivation. It's very much this conscious choice to live below my means, which again is an extremely privileged position to be in. And it's something that I delve into a great deal on frugalwoods.com and also in the book. The book actually opens with a treatment of privilege and with a discussion of income inequality in our country, because I think that's a profoundly important element of this conversation.
Well, we're talking with Elizabeth Willard Thames. Her new book is Meet the Frugal Woods, Achieving Financial Independence Through Simple Living. And Liz, if I can, we got some folks who want to share their own stories, so let me let them into the conversation. Lisa is calling from Boone, North Carolina. You're on the air, Lisa.
Hey, Magna. Thank you. I applaud the author's efforts and direction, but she sounds fabulously wealthy compared to the majority of the people in our rural western North Carolina. A series of counties are very impoverished, and most people live under $20,000 a year, and my partner and I are fortunate enough to have a beautiful falling down farmhouse on a few acres here, and have a small organic farm, and we do very well and consider ourselves very rich, living on probably roughly $25,000 a year. I receive Social Security, I'm a retired nurse, and I work part-time, but I want to work on the farm too, and I want to expand my gardens and my orchard and work with the chickens and all that stuff. So one of the ways I save money, and it's gotten better and better over the years, is I've found an excellent place to dumpster dive, and I'm kind of embarrassed about it. I don't actually go in the dumpster, but you can really get a lot of stuff out that is unbelievable.
Oh, people throw away the most remarkable things. My house is
fabulous.
Furnished. Half my house is furnished with stuff I found on the street.
Me too.
I'm also providing a number of people every time I fill my entire car every Tuesday night, and just last Tuesday, you wouldn't believe this, I got roughly $720 of organic half and half.
Wow.
Case upon case upon case upon case. I'm eating very well on beautiful hams that I got out of the dumpster. I have gotten entire turkeys. I mean, there's nothing wrong with them.
Yeah.
The only thing wrong with them, they were for sale 2 hours ago in the store, and then it reaches that date, that sell-by date, and in it goes. So I've brought home, 100 loaves of bread and cheeses that their only crime is to have been labeled in Spanish. Nothing wrong with it whatsoever. Entire cases.
Lisa, let me just jump in here because I really appreciate all the insight that you're bringing to this conversation. Thank you so much for your call. Let me just turn to another caller quickly before I go back to you, Liz. Issei is calling from Baltimore. You're on the air, Issei.
Hi, Magna.
Issei, are you there?
Hello?
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you now. So give it another try.
Okay. So my question is about the role of community and social positioning, because I've moved around a lot, and it costs a lot of money and time and energy. And I've noticed that friends of mine who stayed where we grew up are able to trade services with people they know. Just like when Mrs. Frugalwoods talked, hand-me-downs, you have to know people for that. Just like the most recent caller, she helps other people out with what she is able to find. And I think that being able to trade and being part of a community can really help people save money when they work together.
Hmm.
But then my other question is about, how to do that as somebody who's not at that stage yet. Because if I want to socialize, I have to leave the house. And it's more likely this to cost money compared to just inviting people over. And then also for people of color, I feel like we pay a higher social price for not being polished. So, for example, having holes in your jeans is going to look one way for a person, like a white person from an upper middle class community, compared to the person who is cleaning their home or gardening.
That's an extraordinarily important question, and I'm very grateful that you brought it to the table. Thank you so much for your call. Liz, let's just start with that one, because I think Issei is exactly right in pointing that, like, embracing frugality looks a certain way if you're white, but society can interpret it entirely differently if you're a person of color.
Absolutely. And, you know, what I always like to say is you don't have to tell anyone that you are being frugal. This can be your own secret. I embraced this lifestyle when I was working at a very professional office, and none of my colleagues knew. No one was aware. All of my clothes came from the thrift store. My coat I found on the side of the road. Great dumpster dive find. No one knew that. And so I think there are ways to look extremely professional and polished without spending the money. My husband cuts my hair, but I keep it in a long style, and I would often put it in a bun when I needed to look very polished. I did all of my own manicures, pedicures, did makeup myself with very inexpensive makeup back when I was still wearing makeup. I learned how to sew clothes, so any holes, rips, things like that, I took care of. And there are ways to be polished. And I think this is something that comes up a lot for women because there is an unfair expectation, I think, that women look and act a certain way. And I certainly did not want to diminish my professional appearance or my professional standing in service of this financial goal. So it can be your secret that you are living the ultra frugal lifestyle.
Let me bring in another guest into this conversation. She's been listening in, and she is an absolute whiz when it comes to issues of personal finance. Michelle Singletary. She's the personal finance columnist at The Washington Post. Michelle, it's great to have you. Welcome to On Point.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Meghna.
You've been listening to this for quite a while, and I appreciate your patience. I was actually wondering if you could start off where we just left off with Issei's question, because I do think there's something important there, that when white Americans may, by choice, those of them who have the choice, embrace frugality, it's seen as a noble pursuit. But if you're a person of color, it might be seen as like you're poor. I mean, how does that play into how we ought to think about money?
It's very true. But I like what Liz said, that you have to define for yourself what penny pinching looked like or frugality. But it is true. And that actually, you know, I'm always cautious when I talk about my own frugality and when I listen to other people talk about it, because you have to be conscious that for some folks, penny pinching, there's no choice. But that doesn't mean that you don't talk about it and don't talk about it as a lifestyle that you can achieve, because the pressure to keep up with the Joneses is so intense for those, you know, who aren't making a lot of money, that they end up wasting money that they absolutely need, and then they get criticized for doing the same thing that the rest of America does. So I want to tell those folks that, you know, it's okay to be frugal because you have no choice, and don't worry about what other folks think.
Yeah, well, so talk to me more about that, because Liz mentioned this before a little bit. The intensity in American culture to show outward signs of your financial success is huge. I mean, how do people resist that?
They don't. And when you have conversations about poverty, the thing that ticks me off the most, that I want to choke people, is like, oh, well, they're on welfare, but look at their kids. They have, you know, designer sneakers. Well, your kid got designer sneakers, and you can't send your kid to college either. You know, I mean, you're whining because you don't have money to send them, because you're doing the same thing. So why would we expect them to do differently? In America, we are living the American dream at all income levels on borrowed money.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this intense pressure. And trust me on this, there are people who go to, you know, Harvard and Yale to figure out how to get you to spend. And it's really hard to combat that. Every time you turn on the television, every time you listen to the radio, I suffer NPR, I love you. You know, there's like, bye, what you have is not good enough. You know, I mean, I've been collecting commercials, car commercials, of them showing people in a new car, and they show other people in a car looking at the person in a new car, and the car they're driving looks like a new car, but that's not a good enough car. How do you combat that?
Well, it starts happening at such a young age. I mean, I know a couple little people in my life who are constantly doing the normal thing. They're asking me for stuff, and I have to say, nope. And literally, like, the catastrophe written all over their faces. Sometimes it's kind of hard to resist.
It is hard to resist. They will ask you, you know, there was this research that showed that children learn, you know, by the time they're, you know, 4 or 5, they know so many brand names, and they've seen over, you know, 40 or 50,000 commercials. And they also know how long it would take for you to say yes. And they, I mean, this is some fabulous research where it's like they ask you 9 times before you go, okay, fine. And so it takes a lot of pressure, you know, not pressure, but, you know, as parents, you have to learn to embrace that word no and be bold about it. And also, you have to have the money to buy a really strong lock to put on your bedroom door so they don't kill you in your sleep. Because they will want to. So, but you got to be bold about it. And I love what you said. My kids, I know. We're standing in the line and we're arguing as they're trying to put stuff on the belt, and you know, people are tapping their foot like, why don't you just get the kid the candy bar? And I'm just like, nope.
What's unique about the human experience, and what do we all have in common? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on TED Radio Hour, we go on a journey through the big ideas, emotions, and discoveries that fill all of us with wonder. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about embracing a life of extreme frugality. Our guests are Elizabeth Willard Thames. She's author of Meet the Frugal Woods, Achieving Financial Independence Through Simple Living. We're also joined by Michelle Singletary, personal finance columnist at The Washington Post. And, you know, even if you're a multi-gajillionaire athlete, such as the fabulous LeBron James, there's still lots of room for frugality. So here's a little bit of tape here. This is October 2017, an interview on ESPN. And King James is responding to how a former teammate, Dwight Wade, asserted that LeBron is, quote, the cheapest guy in the NBA.
That is so, 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 so falsely true. That is so falsely true.
That is so falsely true.
You ain't using his phone if it ain't Wi-Fi.
No, it's like, I'm not what? Doing that. I'm not turning on data roaming. I'm not buying no apps. I still got Pandora with commercials.
Pandora with commercials. That's LeBron James. If he can do it, I guess so can we. Let's zip through a bunch of callers if we can here. Richard is calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Richard.
Hi, Meghna. I, too, applaud your guest and appreciate the conversation here. I'm a retired boomer at 66, and I have lived my entire life frugally. For my generation, we called it voluntary simplicity, and I certainly encourage everyone, no matter what their budget, what their income, consider a lot of the aspects that your guests are bringing up. Part of what I've done my entire life is eliminate the ownership of a car, which is a big part of a personal budget. I get around Worcester on an electric bike, which is not only less expensive, but is way more fun to get around on. And part of my generation's consideration was the sustainability question.
Right.
We've got really, really big planetary issues of sustainability, given climate change and the need to reduce our carbon footprint, and given the sixth mass extinction event, which is accelerating and needing to reduce our impact on the environment that way.
Right. So larger global issues for sustainability that might be reasons to reduce our consumption. Richard, thank you so much for your call. And again, forgive me for interrupting, but so many people want to share their thoughts here. So let's turn to Sarah, who's calling from Springfield, Illinois. Sarah, you're on the air.
Hi, Meghna. I was just curious, your guest, the author's story, I mean, when she talked about entering into frugality, they were already saving like 42% of their income. They already had a house. They both had good jobs, I assume, went to college. And it all just sounds very different than the America I know, very detached from most of the America I know. And I'm curious, like, does she have actual advice for, you know, your average American who's living more paycheck to paycheck?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, barely managing to save a few thousand dollars, or, you know, $1,000 before, you know, hey, maybe your car needs work and that's gone again.
Right, or even barely managing to save anything at all. Sarah, really important question, and thank you so much for your call. Liz and Michelle, your responses. Liz, let me start with you.
Yes. So on frugalwoods.com, I offer a free 31-day challenge called the Uber Frugal Month Challenge, which is designed to help anyone find savings in their budget. So what I've discovered, and I've had, I think, almost 30,000 people take this challenge, everyone has been able to find a way to save a little bit more. And I think for almost anyone, not everyone, but almost anyone, there are some opportunities in your budget. It may be $5 or $10 a month. It may be $50 a month. But ways to trim and to find some greater efficiencies in your spending, and that will add up over time. So it's a long-term proposition, and it's really a question of thinking for the long term and thinking of how to build up that emergency fund so that you can put that buffer between yourself and debt, and how you can pay down your debt so that you can put yourself in a more stable financial position.
Yeah. Michelle Singletary, how does that work for people, as Sarah was asking, who are living paycheck to paycheck?
Yeah, well, you know, the thing is, you have to just, there's two things. One thing I learned from my grandmother, Big Mama, who, you know, didn't make a lot of money. And let me just tell folks, you know, I know every stage of this. I came from poverty. I mean, I actually know real hunger, like there's nothing in the refrigerator hunger, to, you know, being raised by my grandmother to now living very well with my husband, two highly educated folks, sending all our kids to college debt-free. So I get it. I've been there. And what I tell people, what I learned from my grandmother who didn't make very much money, is that always ask yourself, is this a need or is this a want? And then something Liz said, and I think it's very important because the callers are saying it. They're pushing back a little because they're like, hey, this person don't represent the rest of America. But in a way she does, because what she said was, we have a limited amount of resources and we decided that how are we going to live on that money? And it's about value. So let's take it away from frugality and just look at this.
Yeah.
All of you listening, whether you're retired or working, you did something to get whatever you have, whether you're poor or rich. At the end of the day, you can only do so much. Like even LeBron can go broke. So what you have, what do you want to do with what you have? And that might mean you can't do what somebody else does. That might mean your kids can't go out of state to college. That might mean they can't even live on campus because that's all you can afford for them, to just go to community college and then commute to the last two at the four-year university. Just think about what you have and just try to make that work for you, and don't worry about what everybody has. That's the hard part. And that's why you need to be in financial programs. And, you know, we have a financial program at my church, and we teach people all year long how to combat all this stuff. Because, you know, you can get frugality. Like, that's not really that hard. It's for real. It's trying to say, I'm okay only being able to do this because this is all that I have.
Right. But that's the toughest part, right? I mean, it's a profound spiritual transformation.
Yes. It's the mindset.
It takes work. See, people don't want to do the work because it also means that you have to be brave enough to say, if you work in an office, look, I can't. Y'all be going out to lunch all the time. I got to eat my sandwich at my desk. I'm sorry. You know, you having all these birthday parties for your kids. I can't pay that. You know, I did a column about, you know, people are having, you know, they having parties and making the guests pay because they can't really afford the party. That's all of us trying to do stuff we can't afford. But it takes cojones. It takes brave. You got to be brave to be able to say, I'm going to get out of this thing. I'm going to do only what I can afford.
Well, Liz Thames, we've got about a minute to go. So the last thought goes to you today. I'm feeling rather inspired to take yet another look at I'm kind of obsessive about my budgeting as it is, but I'm feeling inspired to go even deeper now.
I think it really comes back to what Michelle is saying. It's about living the life that matters most to you, not the life that matters to anyone else, and not the life that society or your neighbors or your friends say that you should live. What are your priorities, and how can you bring your spending into alignment with those priorities and then ultimately achieve a life that's going to bring you such profound happiness? You're not going to care what anybody else thinks about you. And that is the beauty and the liberation of being financially secure.
With the acknowledgement that it is indeed hard work, Elizabeth Willard-Thames, founder of the personal finance blog Frugal Woods and author of Meet the Frugal Woods, Achieving Financial Independence Through Simple Living. We've got an excerpt of her book at onpointradio.org. Real pleasure to speak with you, Liz. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Magna.
And Michelle Singletary, personal finance columnist for The Washington Post. I know this isn't very professional of me, but can I fangirl for a second? I love your work, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And remember, get that lock for your door and say no to your kids.
It's on my list. Maybe I can make a lock by myself so I won't have to spend money on the actual lock. Michelle, thanks so much. In a moment, you may soon be able to open a checking account with Amazon. This is On Point. Amazon, that retail giant, is now thinking about moving into the financial sector. It's in talks with big banks like JPMorgan Chase about setting up checking accounts that Amazon could offer its customers. The company hopes that the accounts would appeal to younger customers and folks who don't have their own bank accounts already. Joining me now to talk more about this is Emily Glazer, reporter who covers banks for The Wall Street Journal. Emily, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Magna. How are you?
I'm doing very well. So tell me more about this. Is this sort of Amazon dipping a toe into checking accounts, or is this a real plan?
Well, it's a little bit of both. That's a great question. Right now, we know that this is in the early stages. Amazon put out a request for a proposal to put out some sort of checking account hybrid product that Amazon could offer its customers, especially geared toward millennials and those without bank accounts that are commonly known as the un- or underbanked. But it's still in the early stages, and at the end of the day, it still may not come to fruition. So it's one of those situations where time will tell.
Okay, but they would still require the partnership of a major bank like JPMorgan Chase.
Exactly. Amazon's taking a really interesting approach with this, at least checking account proposal and what it's thinking about doing, where it's coming to the table looking for a partner instead of just flat out disrupting an industry, which we've seen so many times from Amazon, commonly now known as the Amazon effect, when it dips its toe or goes fully into an industry and the stocks of other companies in that sector fall. That's not really what's happening here. Amazon is looking to partner with a bank so that it doesn't have to become a bank in order to offer a checking account. And that way, it isn't subject to really stringent regulations that would put certain restrictions on its capital, restrict what kinds of activities it does, and everything else that banks are subject to.
I see. So let the bank bear the regulatory burden here. But, you know, to your point about whenever Amazon makes noises about entering any kind of new market, presidents and CEOs and business owners around the country start having nightmares, right? It keeps them up at night. But if that isn't this, then what is Amazon trying to do here? I mean, I'm seeing some analysis saying that really what it is it's trying to grow its Prime membership market. It's to grow what Amazon already offers by making the financial transactions a bit easier.
That's definitely true. And in our reporting, we found that there are two key reasons why Amazon is considering this. One is to reduce the fees that it pays financial firms, including in some cases credit card processors like Visa and MasterCard. For example, if you're buying something on Amazon, and if you were to choose to use this Amazon-branded checking account that we're talking might, you know, open up one day, instead of a credit card, then Amazon doesn't have to pay a fee to that processor. The other reason is that Amazon is in the data business. It collects so much data about consumers who are shopping on Amazon.com, now consumers that are shopping in Whole Foods grocery stores, and all of the other industries that it's getting into. So learning more about customers' financial habits is huge, and that's going to be very valuable to them as well.
I mean, they really are an information company at the end, aren't they?
Absolutely.
Okay. I'm seeing here, though, that there may be some evidence that there's a lot of receptivity to this idea, right? I'm looking at one survey from LendEDU. They released it on Wednesday, I believe a couple days ago, actually, let me get that right, that found that 45% of respondents were actually open to using Amazon as a primary banking account, and almost 50% would use a savings account created by the company. So that gets us back to what you were saying earlier, that perhaps there is an untapped market here with millennials and the so-called unbanked.
Exactly. And we actually saw some other data the other day from a company called Novantas that does research where they found that more than 40% of about 10,000 respondents say they would be likely to open a checking account if offered by Apple, Google, Facebook, or Amazon. So that's just another survey that clearly consumers are open to this idea. I think that a lot of folks don't understand all the complications that would happen behind the scenes. It's not like Amazon can just open a checking account, and that's why it has to partner with with a bank in this scenario. So clearly consumers are open to it, and especially millennials who are younger, as we've learned, don't care as much about security and privacy as older generations and are very curious to do more with technology firms and, frankly, want things that make their life easier.
I mean, I appreciate that, but just wait until your identity gets stolen for the first time. And then at least with financial security, I suppose people might start caring a little bit more. But in terms of the market here, there are other products already that help with sort of financial transactions that I know are really popular amongst millennials and others, you know, Venmo, things like that, like third-party apps that are already helping facilitate or lubricate financial transitions. So what if you're a J.P. Morgan Chase or any other major bank, instead of partnering with Amazon, why not just fully more aggressively enter that space on your own?
So they're trying to do all of the above, and that's a great question. In response to Venmo, which banks have quietly said, you know, doesn't have great compliance, they're worried that there could be, you know, some sort of problem, and then they're on the hook on the back end since Venmo connects to a customer's or consumer's bank account at the end of the day. They launched Zelle, which is a partnership of a bunch of the big banks that is aimed to compete with Venmo. You know, we haven't seen it pick up so much just yet, but if you're using any of the big banks, and the next time you go to the ATM or a bank, you'll probably see an ad for Zelle because they're trying to get their customers to move and use their own service. The other thing that both Amazon and banks are doing are, besides peer-to-peer payments like Venmo and this newer kind of service called Zelle, is when you're paying for something at a merchant. And so that's more of what Amazon is, you know, a consumer going to a retailer, say, and not using a credit card or cash. And that's where apps like Amazon Pay have come in, Chase Pay, Apple Pay, Samsung Pay. I mean, the list is endless from technology firms, retailers, and banks, but they're not sticking yet. Customers aren't really using them just yet. They're still going for the credit card, debit card, or cash. So what's happening now is that all these firms, whether tech, retail, or banks, are trying to go at it from any way to figure out what will stick with the consumer so that they can continue to have them as a customer,
yeah,
no matter what it takes.
We've got about 30 seconds to go here, Emily. Just want to circle back to one quick thing. I mean, so maybe Amazon is saying right now that it doesn't want to become a bank or enter the financial industry in that way. But they've disrupted just about every other sector they've entered in. So, I mean, how much can we believe that maybe their longer game isn't to disrupt the financial industry?
I think by doing this, they will disrupt the financial industry. We have to see how it plays out. But going back to that idea of partnership rather than disruptor, if they decide, which it seems to be the case right now, that there's too many regulations to become a bank, then they're forced to use a partner.
Right.
So it's a little bit different than other industries that don't have the same level of regulations that banks do.
Well, that's Emily Glazer, a reporter who covers banks for The Wall Street Journal, talking to us about Amazon thinking about somehow offering checking accounts to its customers. Emily, thank you so very much.
Thanks, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Thanks for listening today. This is On Point.